a little bit curious about the effect, the effect that the your prison term had on you. You mentioned the deafness that was the result of the prison term.
Yeah.
Well, how do you account for it?
We'll start at the wrong end first, which is sometimes a better way to do it. When I came out of jail, they organized first a debate between Professor Osborne of Winnipeg, professor of history and French, and me. And we came to the jail, I guess you would know some of these boys. And I said, what about this? We'd have a debate on the League of Nations. And this was Osborne's baby. It was Pet. And I said, well, all right. This will be organized in the Industrial Bureau. And they were hanging from the rafters. Now, these fellows had been, we had debates with Clark and other professors there on economics and so on. So they had kind of access to the university. Well, I said, how do you expect me to deal with the League of Nations? I've been in here some time now. We don't get any newspapers. We do get some information. I said, I'll take it on one condition. You get me a copy of the Covenant. I knew about that. That's what I want. And they got it somehow. That's all I know. And I had it with me in the debate. Now, Osborne was quite an orator, and as in my case with the speech in Winnipeg, it was written. And he delivered it very eloquently. And he quoted Article 10 of the Covenant, and he's looking amongst papers, evidently for this. But in my time, I came up with it, and I could see him, he was quite surprised. And I said, my distinguished opponent has done a good job in presenting his case for the League of Nations, and he quotes Article 10. That is, he quotes part of it. In point of fact, he quotes two parts of it, the beginning and the ending, which in this instance is like having a preamble and a peroration and no exordium. And I said, now you working stiffs, you can go to a dictionary and look that up. But it means that he's taken the head and the tail and left the guts out. And he'd better put them back in, because I have them here and I've read them out to this 20,000 people in this place. And I was sick by then. But I hung onto the table and on the back of the chair this time. And this old George Anderson, one of them, he said, I listened to you, Bill. He said, now, for God's sake, why didn't he let go of that chair? Well, I was falling down. What I did do, I went home from that shop bed. Meantime, the wife had been getting rid at about 9% of what she paid for it, of a little bit of furniture she had for living in, and we were preparing to come home. And off they went. And an old John Houston, who had been a professor in some place or other, he was quite a boy, trade unions, he had died. And I should have gone to the funeral, and here I was. When they came in to see me, I was sitting on top of a tin trunk in the corner of the room, against the wall. And I was to have gone that afternoon and debated with Professor Clark on free trade. And Adolf Cohn of the SPGB happened to be in town, and he was quite a debater. And I said, get hold of Cohn. At a moment's notice, he took that debate.
Now, this was in Winnipeg.
Yes.
After your release. Is this what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yes, I see.
Just a week or so after.
Oh, yes.
All right. They brought the doctor and they took me to some home there and treated me. Kept me for 2 weeks in Winnipeg. And instructions not to go to northern Saskatchewan town. Saskatoon.
Yeah.
The Bar Association wanted me to go there and talk on the trial. Well, I answered them that when I got an invitation from the Trade and Labour Council, I would go. But I wasn't going to get mixed up with any other lawyers for some time yet. That was an edingo. Well, so the doctor said, you can go home, but it'll take 2 weeks. Now, break your journey. I happened to have...
And what was wrong? Was this just fatigue? Was it fatigue, or had you picked up some virus?
Well, what happened, something went through that jail, and it knocked everybody out, and I got it. And I was preparing for the second presentation of Pinafore.
Oh, yeah.
The first one had been such a success. Well, the boy who had conducted it was a young Scotch kid, and he was in there for an antisocial act. He's what they call a paper hanger. He had forged something to get some money. And he had quite a knowledge of music. And he had conducted this whole thing in which I took the part of the captain. Well, now I'm out. So the second presentation, he goes up and takes the captain's part, and they sent for Dr. Oh, what was the name of the fellow that had the Winnipeg Operatic Society? He came into the jail and he conducted that thing, you know. Noted where we had cut it, and
was it
signified it, eh?
Was it G?
No, no. This is 1920. And so, there it was. Then, what happened next, I don't remember, because I was unconscious. 2 weeks. And believe me, that was the sweetest 2 weeks that I put in jail. Because I didn't know anything, I didn't realize anything. And when I woke up, I realized with some satisfaction, it's closer to time to going out, you know. Which is this time. But they wrote in the press then that if anyone wanted to see opera in Winnipeg, they shouldn't go to the Walker Theatre. And some other place, you go down to the county jail. I think the Attorney General's name was Johnson. He came down to it, and a fellow named Eddie, Big Bill Eddie, was the officer for against the liquor, the prohibition man. And I made a parody on it. Well, you know that Big Bill Eddie is here, you know, and made stuff on him. And I know on the song 40 Years an Englishman, there was some member of the government who was a bachelor. I would put it on to him. 40 Years a Bachelor. He might have been a bigamist, a Mormon, or a polygamist, with 30 wives or more. And the chorus would come into them, or 30 wives, oh Lord! There's a lot of fun. And so from time immemorial, dealing with all points uxorial, he remains a bachelor. And I got this crowd in the first time, out training. When they sang that, they laughed it out. She said, ba-ha-ha-ha-ha, all the way to a laugh. Well, we had to make Buttercup out of Dope Addict. He was a very funny man. He was a very funny man, this. He had a sense of humor that were, it didn't matter what you rehearsed or what you decided, he would bring in something spontaneous, much funnier. But then you couldn't use it because if you rehearsed on that, he changed the damn thing. You had to leave him. He was the buttercup. And he forgot his cue and didn't come on stage and somebody thrust him on. And then, well, now what do you do? We have a pianist who was bald-headed that we call the Seven Sutherland Sisters, and he had returned soldiers. How he got into the trouble, I don't know, but he's a very good pianist. We got a spotlight from Ralph Connor's church. I know. We made the curtain out of as many sheets as we could get from the upstairs, the ladies' place, and had them sewn together. And rigged up the pulleys, and to provide weight so they would come down, we loaded the corners with knives and forks, and tied that knot. And I was supposed to come out and take a bow after singing the captain's song, and I almost got my head knocked off with these knives and forks. Bang! They went. Well, George Armstrong had come back into jail by this time, and this is used as the church, you know. YMCA came up, and the only service I went to was the Catholic. That's the only service I went to, and for good reason. Because I was invited by the priest for a purpose, which was more than I got from the Protestants or other sects. However, George Armstrong built an extension of a platform, and then we built the row of lights. We extended the stage, and they kept it that way. Next, when they were put it on later, and they later did, and I was out then, they did trial by jury. By this time, the curtains were not sheets. They were velvet curtains. And the reason they got velvet curtains was I sat at the door of the jail when the lawyers would come in to see clients. Now, most of these clients had lost their cases. And I found that they lost their cases chiefly because the lawyer wanted to make an appeal. So I said, you fellows do very well on your job, you know. I tapped every one of them. Oh, I'm trying to think of some fellow, he slipped $20 long. I said, we've turned the church into a theatre. It still functions as a church, but that's only once a week. But we've put shows on here. And we need a better curtain. We can get them. They got plush curtains there, properly balanced.
Not every producer has a captive audience.
So you see, the governor was one of these rehabilitation men. He was an honor fellow, and that's it. He was a peculiar fellow. I could handle him very well. His wife, she doted on me because I did something in this regard. She wanted to see a better tone in these concerts the fellows were putting on. Well, we did that. And not only that, we brought in the Labour Church Choir once a month. They would come to that. Mm-hmm. And once a month we brought in the Winnipeg Symphony. And Charlie Manning at that time was the flautist. You remember Charlie Manning?
I got a picture here.
Of course, Father Charlie. He went on
the Winnipeg Sun.
He went on the plains and got away from the war.
From the socialist.
And there was a row about taking him into the symphony when he came back. Now Chadwick, that was the name of the man. He was a returned soldier, and he was the leader at that time, and a good violinist. Oh, God, yes. So, they put on a concert, and these fellas, a lot of fun, and they brought in piles and piles of tobacco. We weren't supposed to have it. Well, I just scurried around and found places to catch this. You could have got a trumpet that was hidden over there, an old trumpet, and then if you'd have blown, you'd have blown about 50 cigars out of that thing. I had charge of the storage. Well, the governor wanted to know what kind of a program it would be. Now, you can tell these fellows had a sense of humor. They talked to me about, what shall we play? So we looked over, and we picked out the most difficult titles and the foreign names, difficult of pronunciation, and they had a kick. This fellow stood up and he solemnly delivered every item through his glasses, so really. You couldn't tell Tchaikovsky, you know, from Berkovich, when he told it, and they laughed. Yeah. Then they got around the jail. They weren't disorderly, but they couldn't run the jail that way. We had some great concerts. Charlie Manning brought in his girlfriend, who was a soprano, and they played that. Heart of the Lord. No, it's not the Lord. Yeah. Go ahead.
Will you tell us something about the reception that you got when you arrived back in Vancouver?
Yes, of course, I was still a sick boy. A gang got onto the train in Port Moody to meet me, 12 miles up the line. And when I got to the depot, the platform was crowded,
the whole of the foyer packed, yet and the streets outside were crowded, and there's a return soldier named Sullivan on a horseback, and he was the marshal of the return soldiers who came to greet me. And the trouble with it was that the world made a mistake and reported it truthfully, that this was a greater reception than the Prince of Wales had had the week before. That trouble point really, you know. I was just going through, and then this daughter that I lost, she was then just stayed here with friends. In fact, one she stayed with is in Portland now, and it's J. Christmas home on Austin Road. I went up to see him, and he had my daughter on his shoulder, and I remember saying, I said, Daddy, that's it.
How old was she then?
19. 21, 4.
And didn't you have a wife then? Didn't you have a wife then?
Yes, she was with me.
Oh, I
and the two boys.
Oh.
But she was in the background somewhere. You get through a crowd like that, you get through one at a time. And I then went up to my dad's place to the house and stayed there. And then they had a parade on the Sunday morning, I think it was, and Dad took me downtown and put me in a doorway, expenses. Stay back in the doorway. Because if I'd been discovered, I couldn't stand it. It was quite a parade. But they did have a meeting on the ground on which the bus station is now, Greyhound bus station.
To welcome you back.
Yeah. We stayed off at these friends in Moscow for a week, and then we made a break from the journey back to France, and I got into the hot pool in a wheel. We walked up there, and I got in there. That did me quite a bit of good. But I had this running of the ear close to 6 months. And of course, they developed this as a lady doctor. Carried a lot of disease, she said it was pretty well done. Then she, you know, they put the plastic in the whatever it is. She pulled it all up in. And they put her finger in it. She said, there's such a small hole. Ah, I said, I'm glad they're not. That's the reason that so little gets in there. I have trouble wearing that gadget.
Were the other prisoners from the state trials in the same jail with you? Russell and...
No, Russell was in Stony Mountain in a separate trial. We were in the provincial jail.
Queen?
Queen, Heap, not Heaps, Queen, Jail.
Island.
Then we all were sent out to this farm. We wanted to get out of that place. We went out to work. And they discovered a wonderful thing, according to the chief. He reported that these men work. And they know how to do jobs, Kinsley. They know how to do jobs that other people couldn't do. I repaired the governor's house. It was leaking. And Mrs. Morris was quite worried, and I took a look up there, and I said, no wonder it leaked. Whoever put the flashings in there, put them up the wrong way up. Take it, not to carry the water out, but to take it in. I had to reverse all those and that and done. And then I did all the job. And we went out to clear ground, post stumps, big post holes, and the frost was in the ground still in July, you know. And they couldn't make out what it was, and we got crowbars and bounced into it, and then up comes bits of ice. So I think it's funny that after we put a fence in and drink the post holes, and then put a fire in the post holes before we drive in the fence. So we pointed them all, we had good axes, and a big maul that Armstrong made us to drive them in, they came all, the point was all mushrooms. So I amused myself on that job. writing a kind of epic of man's growth.
Did you have lots of discussions amongst yourselves?
Oh, I can tell you that one. But the Murray came down one day, and we had already now got about close to more than a furlong, the line set with the post set, and I'm on this with the square, and setting the colours in order to get the right place. He says, "My goodness, that is straight. That's what you expect. That's what I'm here for." That's why I was putting it, to see that this line goes straight, and I'm striking it. It's an easy job. It was a miracle to me. Just like Ward Holland, Nigel Lloyd. We're in the room in the courthouse, and it was cold weather. The radiator was going, and they're blowing off steam. It was a little valve. There was a break in the proceedings. So we met out, and he said, "This is wonderful." And I said, "What's wonderful?" "The radiator." And I said, "What's wonderful about it?" Well, he said that they could make those sections, and they'd fit together in such a way that the steam won't escape. I said, "It comes out through a little valve there." He said, "I know that, but it's a wonderful." Oh, to a lawyer. I said, "That's what I meant by I accused you fellows of having an indoor mind." Now, I wanted to tell you, if there's a machinist apprentice that couldn't surface those surfaces right, he'd be fired. That's what's wonderful about it. But even boys in their apprenticeship know how to do this wonderful thing you talk about. It's all wonderful to them. Well, old Barner and Murray, they got it, they took it, but the other fellows, they didn't like it. I accused them of having indoor minds, and they want to know what I meant by that. I said, "It's a mind that never opens itself to the outside."
Was your wife living in Winnipeg during your...
During the trials, she came out from here. Left the girl here and brought the two boys.
But when you went to prison, she went back to Vancouver, did she?
No.
She stayed here.
She lived in North Winnipeg. That's what I tell you, when she sold the stuff, she bought at a high price and sold it at less than 9%. A little over 12 months. Oh, she would stay here. Of course, they'd taken everything out of the house. It looked like a book. Anything looked like a book out of my house. You see, one officer gave testimony. I think it was one of asking what we were instructed to do to search these places. Why? What were we looking for? Anything that had to do with the Winnipeg Trades Council, with the Labour News, with the Labour Church, with the OBU, with the Socialist Party, the Social Democratic Party. That's what they were looking for. That's what they were told to take. Well, then they came up, another policeman, and they never brought up the fellow that got into my place. I was looking for him. So I've got to go again, left-handed, and ask this second one. My special one. That the previous officer had testified that they were instructed to get such and such and such and such. He said, "Yes." Well, I said, "I suppose that if you came across papers that said Winnipeg Labour News, you picked those up." And I listed a few of them. Yes. And I suppose the officer that raided my house had the same instructions. He said, "Of course, we all have the same instructions." Well, I said, "I would like to know your opinion of an officer who was so instructed, who not only took the things for which he was instructed to look, but took everything look like a book, including two record catalogues of Columbia and RCA and a couple of Bibles. Were you instructed to raid a man's house and take his Bible? He said, "No." Well, I said, "That happened to me, you know. And then now I'm giving evidence, and they took me off. But I gave it. That's what happened in my place."
How many books did you have in your library?
I don't know now, but today's prices, because many of them you can't get, they're going to thousands of dollars.
And you never recovered them?
No.
Did you try?
Oh, yes. Armstrong got his back, you see. I'm the only one that never got, and I had probably more than any of them. I had Laurier's Economic Foundation, that's quite a volume. Thorold Rogers, big volume, 6 centuries of work and wages, apart from all the sources.
And why wouldn't they give them back to you?
I suppose they burned them. I never get any satisfaction in all of them. But I do know that I asked the judge, I think I told you, if he wanted to know, was there anything now that they might do for me? And I said, I had always been a reader, and I didn't see how I could live anywhere without books. I will see to it, he said, that books are sent into you. And Mary, what do you think they were doing? They took the very books that have been used as exhibits in the case and sent them into jail so we could read them. Three volumes of Marx Capital. Oh my God. I ran a class on economics for a while in there. And I taught school for a month.
What did you teach?
Anything that they wanted to know. Now, he was a kid that had gone through high school, he was in mathematics, and I still had enough connection with my early training to know a little algebra. I went into that. Others wanted to know a little bit of literature. There's some that I got interested in Dickens, and whatever it was. But I asked them all to write. And there was an old Italian that couldn't even write Italian. And he was only in for 3 months. Well, I did get a book. I think it was issued in the States, and it's called Basic English for Beginners. But amongst this group, there was a Polak who lived on the border of Germany, and some German knowledge, and I retained most of what I got in the course in German that time to be able to. By certain things. So we got along with that. And I got this old Italian district and got him to form letters. Couldn't do much more. But what I did do, under my instruction, was guide him to write a letter for him. His own handwriting. Short letters. And he wrote it in the US style, he wrote it in Benedict to sign his name. The crudest copper plate you ever saw was this fellow's name. That was really big. Rather than other shows. He sent the letter off. I brought him to write. I just came in. Well, we went down to jail. And when I came back, I'm all in by the new wife of the governor. He got married while we were away. He was a widower and he married a widow. But fortunately, she got him to have the government appoint her chief matron. There was an old lady that was a matron. And what I did with this new lady, she came in to see me, and that's when she was talking about these concerts, the fellows were putting on pretty crude. She wanted them made a little more respectable and put something in them. So we put together a sort of review to start with. And I got this idea if I could put on pinafore. And then I went on and I went to the governor and said, well, I need someone from the outside. He said, oh no. I said, oh yes. I need a baritone. And I know one. He's a machinist, and he's in the Labour Church choir. And he has to take the baritone. No, we had some singers among them. I went down to the jail, and we had two of the guards. One who was in the comic, but there was a fellow named Lloyd, and he came from Liverpool. And he had a very nice tenor voice.
What was the reaction in the prison, first of all, among your group, and then among the prisoners and the governor, when you found out that Queen and Ivan and
We were on the jail farm then. There weren't many, many. There was only about 18 altogether on that business. And we had a special recess in the dining room for ourselves. I objected to that. I didn't want to be separated. But it was just as well because one of the fellows that came out to work with us disappeared from the gang. The guard got panicky. I said, he's not going anywhere. He was all this jungle and wasteland and was thinking of the American border about 90 miles away. No, I said, he'll come back. And he came back. And he came back to the top of the cartridges for some reason. And they are out of season at that time of the year. Well, of course he brought them for us. And we had a cook who was in from Conway. He did spend one story, that cook. But he couldn't cook. But at least he got these cartridges and he cooked them in butter. You could have smelled them all the way to Transcona. And this was our supper. Now, we knew very well the guards could smell it, the governor could smell it, and certainly the prisoners could smell it. And, you know, I didn't like that. We were being treated by accident. We were being treated better.
Well, when these three were elected members of the legislature and they are officially convicts, were they able to function from inside the jail as members of the legislature?
I don't think they had long to wait before the legislature opened. They were out by the time it opened.
Were they?
Yes. Oh, no. I always remember Ivans and George Armstrong, John Queen, they rode in hard for this, you know. Really. Pompous. It was pompous.
John Queen?
No, Bill Ivans. Of course he was an artist. He hadn't got over his Methodist ministry, you know, holding forth. Of course he got him out of the church, but he had his points. And that's why I take them and I find them, and with all those men, there was unanimity on the one point, and that was the workers' problem in Winnipeg. Despite political differences. But Bill said, they were talking about what would they do when they got out. They were now all back in the jail, because bad weather had come on. And one said one thing, one said another. And Bill said another. And Bill said very dramatically, I shall go from this government institution here to that government institution over there. And he was going to make a long speech, and I told him, I said, Bill, if you, when you get there, you have to speak to me, a maiden speech, make it short. Keep it short. And I have some substance in it. You know, he likes a lot. But he didn't make it short, I understand. And he went from this institution to that institution over there, and they said to me, well, philosophically, Bill, what are you going to do when you get out? I said, you mean the first morning? Yeah. Well, I'm going to have a damn good feed of hominids. And that was my ambition, and it was necessary. But I wasn't even informed to take it when I did that. Now, the other great days, now you went to Transcona, then the man I visited yesterday, Mr. William Day, that was just around the corner from where I was, my sister's place. He was in Transcona coming back from the war. I think Armstrong was holding a meeting there. Transcona. I was invited to Transcona after the release.
Transcona is a little place outside of Winnipeg, where the Canadian National Railway has a shop.
Railroad shop. But they're all there and falling, all there and falling, and I'm on the platform. And I wanted to rest. And they had a band which blew very well. It blew till you couldn't blow any blue. Well, I wasn't deaf then either. But maybe that has something in it. I forget what they played. Home Sweet Home, or All Lang Syne, or something appropriate like that. And these brashes, you know, up pitch, but doing very well. Right, see these guys in the States. You get somebody up to sing what I call the national Donald Duncan. And
you have to train a long time to sing
off pitch so much. It's quite a job, and they do it. And they can sing despite the fact that a piano or an orchestra is playing the accompaniment. I wondered how piano players could keep in tune while listening to those voices. Knock them over. See, this girl's father, and by the time I went to, California, I'd been a close friend of his then for 20 years. He was quite a singer. And I remember a fellow who didn't think much of him. He said to me, that fellow knows how to sing. He said, but the trouble is that he knows it. Well, the trouble with you is that you know it. And what you're doing is telling me something that I know. I know he can sing, but he doesn't know how to sing. We had great times together. Mark might have neither seen it nor appropriate in the court of law. Otherwise, the thing doesn't go through. Because Clifford Sifton was the man in government who made a last appointment and the power to make an appointment as a judge to a judgeship. And the man he appointed was Metcalfe. Now, the farmers knew that. And they knew Clifford Sifton. They knew what they had suffered under him. And now, get that across. I couldn't tell them what I was after, but they got it. The judge got it too, because that's when he rapped, and I went out for lunch. Yeah. In fact, if you look at it, remarks like that have no place anyway in the speech, without the surrounding circumstances and explanation.
Bob Edwards was a good source for that type of humor.
Oh, yeah.
That's a real Western favorite to him.
Of course, Arthur was only a
favorite to him.
Of course, Arthur was only a tinsel copy of Clifford.
Yeah. Clifford, I believe, all during the strike was in either in Toronto or in London.
I didn't know he was only with Free Press, but Defoe was the editor.
Yes. But Defoe, at least Sifton, was the owner that brought Defoe to become the editor. When Clifford Sifton bought over the Winnipeg Free Press from a man named Luston,
oh,
who was also who was a conservative politician in Winnipeg, he cast about for an editor, and he brought Defoe from Montreal, where he was the just a reporter on the Montreal Star. And that was around the time that Clifford Sifton was member of the Laurier government.
Hmm. Well, he was the man that made the appointment of Metcalfe for judgeship.
So Defoe himself took a very, very anti-strike position.
Anti-strike?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
In fact, I think you made a remark in your speech about a coal miner with his pickaxe, right? What was that statement? Do you remember that? You were talking about the Free Press.
The miners in the coal in this past that could write better editorials on the face of the rock with their picks than the editor of the Free Press could with his pen.